Okay. Allison, could you start by telling the audience a little bit more about your work history, up to and including your current role at Mora Ventures?
Yeah, so to even take it a little bit earlier, I went to Georgetown, like you, Trip, and studied foreign service. So goal initially was to save the world, and maybe I'm closer now than I was maybe 15 years ago. But did foreign service at Georgetown and went straight into banking, right? So moved into the Royal Bank of Scotland, into kind of like their bad bank investment banking team in London. And most of what I did there was basically taking a lot of the assets that were debt for equity swaps. So almost like a ad hoc internal private equity team, helping the bank package these assets, which were anything from one of the largest private jet fleets in the world, which were failed leases and container ships, to also the luggage brand Samsonite, IPO, sell, do what we could, right? So I did that for about 5, 6 years, but the goal of my job was to make my job obsolete, right? To package and get rid of as much as we could on the balance sheet. So from there, I moved over to the Carlyle Group and did mostly emerging markets, but public equities. So I worked in a hedge fund on the market side of Carlyle that did larger emerging markets. So a little bit of LATAM, I would say mostly Brazil and some Mexico, Asia, so China, India, some of the larger markets, and EMEA. Did that for 3, 4 years, maybe a little bit longer. I'm dating myself now. And then moved into VC. I guess what I realized that I liked the most about my work was the humanistic elements of going out, trying to find deals, especially as it related to public markets and emerging markets. The liquidity issues still made it kind of feel like PE. So moved into growth stage VC. So I joined a firm in New York called Starvest Partners, which was investing out of its third fund at the time, which is about $250 million, mostly in Series B, B2B SaaS, but focused on the US. So I went from emerging markets, which I loved. I went into VC, which I ended up loving, but doing US focused. However, realizing at the time that getting into a Series B deal, and the situation is so much different now, and 9 years later, that everything was kind of overpriced, right? I mean, when you're getting into a Series B deal, the companies are already valued at $50 million-$100 million. So for the fund to realize a 10x on each of those investments, you had to essentially assume that hopefully a few of your investments were going to be unicorns. So realizing kind of that dynamic, but then the opportunity set of emerging markets, I moved down to Puerto Rico in 2017, right before the hurricane, which was a story for another day or later in the podcast, and launched what we currently have today as Mora Ventures. So because of the hurricane, we more or less launched the fund in kind of late 2018, early 2019, to be an early stage VC that it invests across Latin America.
And so could you tell me about the size of the fund, the LPs, and then and let's discuss some of the fundraising process. Like, how is that first time fund manager doing that?
Sure. So the first time fund, kind of a proof of concept, right? Could we be based in Puerto Rico? I'm obviously gringuísima, no? I'm from the States. My business partner is Chilean. But could we raise this fund based in Puerto Rico that invests regionally? So we targeted 20 million and we reached our 20 million target. The composition of our LP base was a little bit organic, or how we kind of put it together, I guess, to also answer your question in terms of fundraising. So I, to put it in kind of like a timeline, I moved down to Puerto Rico in March of 2017, and the hurricane hit us in September of 2017. This was the bad hurricane, if people remember. I know it's 6 years ago, but people still talk about it, obviously, here, that wiped out everything. So our goal initially, speaking from like March until September, was just to be a regional fund. I would say since the hurricane hit and we started talking to potential investors, the core of the narrative remained the same, but we recognized the impact we could also have on Puerto Rico by being based here, being a local capital pool, and be able to aggrandize in some way, shape, or form the local entrepreneurial ecosystem. So I like that it's the common term is an ecosystem, right? Because you can't just have one facet and think that startups are going to thrive, right? So in Puerto Rico, when I moved in 2017, there was already a few local accelerator programs, most of which were publicly funded or kind of operating as nonprofits. There were increasingly more people moving down to Puerto Rico from the states that were successful business owners because of the tax incentives to bring them here. But what there wasn't to kind of round out that ecosystem was a local capital pool. Granted, again, like there's high net worths moving down, mm-hmm. which could be angel mm-hmm. investors, but it wasn't like part of the mindset at the time. So we raised this fund, dual purpose, dual mission, to both help Puerto Rico develop as a location for entrepreneurship and company development, but also invest across LATAM, because Puerto Rico is a market of 3 million people, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think it would be a disadvantage to our investors if we only had our capital invested locally.
So could you tell us a little bit more about both the Puerto Rico entrepreneurial ecosystem, and then are there like some of the companies that are coming out of it, and like if you've invested in any of the big ones, or tell us about that?
Yeah, for sure. So it's grown massively since, I would say, 2016 is at least the period in which I became more mentally aware, you know, familiar. A lot had happened before that too. But I'm going to refer to 2016 because I can at least speak from direct experience as opposed to kind of making up history. So in 2016, what was established was one of those accelerator programs that I mentioned, which is called Parallel 18, which was a little bit of a, not a copy, but like an analog of Startup Chile. So it worked in Startup Chile. They tried to bring to Puerto Rico through Parallel 18. The reason that Startup Chile was the model for Parallel 18 is, first, my business partner is Chilean. So he had personal connections in Chile who were integral to the composition or to the team of Startup Chile, who could help us or help him, Cyril at the time, bring the program to Puerto Rico. But also one of the core reasons that the government of Chile started Startup Chile was they had a brain drain issue. So a lot of students that would leave, say, Chile for graduate school or even undergrad, maybe for the States, Europe, a lot of them would stay, right? So they were trying to also combat this brain drain issue, how do we get smart, driven individuals that are Chilean back to Chile with ambition and an achievable goal of creating a company locally, right? So because that was also what Puerto Rico was trying to achieve, that was kind of the reason for bringing over Startup Chile. Because as many may or may not know, being a Puerto Rican makes you a full U.S. citizen. Even though we're a Commonwealth colony, everyone born in Puerto Rico gets a U.S. passport. So if you're a smart, driven individual like the Chileans, you go to university in the States, a lot stay in the mainland, right? So this program was launched back in 2016. I first became acquainted in 2017. I was a visiting judge for their first demo day. And the goal from the beginning was to bring in companies from outside of Puerto Rico as well. So the accelerator programs before Parallel 18 were mostly locally focused. So just local founders, local companies, a lot of them, just because that was the composition of the companies as well, were helping companies that were mostly family owned, trying to rethink maybe their next growth strategy, et cetera. Parallel 18 from the beginning had more of the Startup Chile mindset, and that they wanted to bring companies from outside, founders from outside, and try to help people that grew up on an island better understand the thought processes and mindsets of those that are outside. So from there, a lot has happened. We have a number of companies, many of which are in the portfolio. So I would say our top performing Puerto Rican company in the portfolio at the moment is Raincoat Insurance, which is an infrastructural play for parametric insurance related to weather-based issues. So hurricanes, inclement weather as it relates to rainfall, especially for farmers, et cetera. They've raised from Anthemis, SoftBank, Two Sigma, and Mundi Ventures since we entered back in December of 2019. And then there's also some solutions that are trying to revolutionize consumer lending, because Puerto Rico also is in this interesting kind of gray area, in that a lot of LATAM funds don't look at it because we're part of the States, but US funds also won't look at us because we're Puerto Rico. And that also applies to credit funds, right? So a lot of credit options are not as pervasive or available as in the States. So right now, I would say of our portfolio of 21 companies, about four are primarily based in Puerto Rico, and another three on top of that have significant operations in Puerto Rico. So about a third of our portfolio of the 21 companies has a link to Puerto Rico. So far, we've been able to stick to our mission.
Amazing. And so you've probably mentioned hurricanes on this podcast more than maybe any other VC podcast ever.
Unfortunately.
So let's discuss that. So, you know, what made this hurricane so crazy? And then I think, you know, let's just start out, you know, Puerto Rico, it's the United States, but it's also Latin America, but it's not
Yeah.
Miami. So could you maybe give like a bit of a background to like, you know, the uninitiated on Puerto Rico and then
Sure,
kind
sure,
of
sure.
build that into, you know, the hurricane and how that affected that?
Yes. So Puerto Rico is one of three zones. I'm going to call it zones because the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is a collection, falls into the same kind of category. And that we're a commonwealth, which I think is a modern day or euphemistic way of saying colony. So there's Guam, there's Puerto Rico, and there's the U.S. Virgin Islands for the most part that fall within this designation. So we are part of the states, but we do not vote for the president because we operate outside, which essentially what that means, and going back to the US Revolution, is we have no taxation without representation. Since we're not directly represented in Congress, we have like an observer, almost to use like a VC board term, but we don't have a vote, and we don't vote for the president directly as a populace. So we're not taxed by the federal government. So when I lived in London, I paid federal tax. I live in Puerto Rico, I don't pay federal tax. So what this means is that Puerto Rico has been able to develop its own tax structure completely, right? Which means that it can incentivize US taxpayers to move down to Puerto Rico because if you're a high net worth individual paying a lot to the Fed or the IRS, you can move here and you only pay local tax. If the local tax rate is, say, 0% for your capital gains or 4% for your business, that's incredibly attractive, right? For you to move yourself and your family down to Puerto Rico from New York, San Francisco, et cetera, which is what's been happening and what I alluded to in terms of a lot of high net worths coming down as mentors, angel investors, but it still didn't like substantiate the full ecosystem when we raised the fund. So Puerto Rico kind of falls into this limbo, right? For better or worse, there's positives and there's negatives. Tying in the hurricane, right? So the hurricane passed and it devastated. There was two hurricanes that happened in succession, Irma and then Maria in 2017. Irma was the one that kind of wiped out the Virgin Islands, and then Maria was the one that wiped out us in parts of the DR, right? Just bad all around. And I think Irma also hit kind of the Bahamas and everything. Anyway, so being part of the US, we got a lot of aid, which it's still kind of trickling down to the island and making a massive, having a massive benefit, right? Especially given that the economy has kind of been on a roller coaster. Getting a lot of federal funds during this kind of the last 12 to 18 months has helped the island immensely, massively, immensely. So where we stand and how we've been trying to kind of help the island and why Puerto Rico, right, is there hasn't been, again, like a lot of the public funds that look at Latin America don't look here. US funds don't look here. We've been benefiting from federal funds that have come down, many of which have been kind of earmarked for accelerator programs, company development, which has helped. But it's been difficult to kind of get the private sector focused in Puerto Rico. The hurricane did change that as well, and that Puerto Rico was more in the news, right? And people understood the problems that were happening in Puerto Rico. Because previous to the hurricane, and even since, unfortunately, we've been in an economic depression. The name of the game, because we're in an island economy, the government has a pretty heavy role, right, in doing economic redistribution. They usually do that through tax incentives, as many island economies do. They had disposed, or they hadn't renewed a previous tax incentive, which brought a lot of manufacturing down to the island. And I mention this because they didn't renew it kind of in the late 90s, early 2000s, but these things are the operative decrees. So a lot of it rolled off into the 2008, 9 period. So when the global financial crisis happened in 2008, 2009, it was also kind of inopportune that this also meant a lot of the manufacturers from the pharmaceutical industry, especially, were leaving the island. So Puerto Rico was in a bad spot financially, economically. When the hurricane hit, Puerto Rico was more in the news, and the problems, not only the hurricane, but the economic problems, became more aware, right? Or there was greater awareness in the media of the problems, which helped both us raise capital admittedly from U.S. persons that had an interest in Puerto Rico and helping in some capacity. But also, again, bringing Puerto Rico, I think, back to the glory or the position that it should be in as a part of the U.S. that has economic opportunity. It just, we need kind of to create a virtuous cycle again where capital and people stay on the island.
I can tell you about like your life there. Like, is it, like, I can understand you go to Miami for tax incentives, and then like it's a city that like everybody wants to be in. I kind of know, and I think the public consciousness knows less about like what a life would be like in Puerto Rico. You know, what is that like? Like, are there a lot of young people? Is it mostly older people? Like, of the people who come from like the 50 states, is that mostly like older high net worth individuals? Or, I know we know Ali, who's been on the podcast. Like, tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. So I would say that it's changed a lot since the hurricane. Again, using like my own like point of reference, but the tax incentives to encourage high net worth individuals to move down started in like 2014. Hurricane hit us in 2017. There's always like a few years that you need to like, organically distribute the information. People are like, how can this be real? I pay almost 50% living in New York City. How could I pay, between 0 and 4% living in Puerto Rico? This, this is a scam, la, la, la.
Right.
So things have changed. I mean, you live in the Caribbean, for better or worse, right? So awesome in that behind me, you can't see it, but it's the ocean. I live on the ocean as well. But I live on an island, right? So 85 to 90% of our food is imported. If I want to fly to Santiago, Chile, it takes me 14 to 16 hours. Get to Mexico City from Puerto Rico is 9 hours. Island. It's island.
So
because there's no direct flights. I go through Panama or I go through Houston or Miami.
Wow.
So it's a little isolating in that regard, right? But you live on the beach, you make it work. Now, since Zoom, things have improved. So to come back to your question, what is like the composition, I would guess, of like younger people or people that are the audience, right, of your podcast? Increased, right, since COVID, when remote work became more of a common thing. Again, we're on Zoom right now, no? And Zoom has made island life increasingly easier. So a lot of people have moved down, mostly from, to answer your question, like where, mostly from San Francisco. Again, I'm relating back to like my experience, cause those are the circles I operate within. New York, people from Texas as well, because I would say for the most part, they're Republicans, and we've had a Democratic administration in the White House for the last 4 years. So that's increased the people from Texas and Florida to an extent. But like you said, I mean, a lot of Floridians are hardcore Floridians and haven't moved from Miami to Puerto Rico.
And what are those people doing in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, so I guess this also ties to your question on, is it younger people or older people? So the tax incentives, and again, not to belabor this point, have been a massive pull for a lot of mainlanders to move down to Puerto Rico. Mainlanders come down as well, right? For other reasons, but the tax incentives have been at least a sweetener, if not the driving force. The best part of the tax incentives is the 0% capital gains, which means that it lends itself most readily to somebody who's living off of his or her stock portfolio or portfolio of assets. Right? Because typically those assets, even if it's short-term or long-term capital gains, it's capital gains. People that are active income earners, for example, I'm an active income earner in Puerto Rico, I pay tax. I pay like 18% tax, right? So I'm here for other reasons, but it's mostly older people that are semi-retired, living on an island sounds nice, right? They don't have to put their kids. There's good schools down here, but there's only a few. So they don't have to put their kids in school. They don't travel as much for work because, like I mentioned, work travel is more difficult here than elsewhere. So it's late. It's older generations or kind of the tech nomads, some people that are starting their companies. Because again, if you start your company here, when you sell your company, it's 0% capital gains if you're a US citizen.
Wow.
So I would say there's maybe those two kind of like semi-retired or retired that are living off of a stock portfolio. I would also put like traders in there. So people that make most of their money just on short-term capital gains. And then kind of these tech entrepreneurs that can do everything, especially through like a remote team, have moved down because when they sell their company, hopefully for, you know, millions, they don't have to pay tax on that.
Wow. Okay. And so what is next for Moro Ventures?
I know, right? Millions coming back to the point. We're about to raise fund two. So we successfully deployed fund one. Super happy with kind of how it's panned out. Like I said, 7 out of the 21 companies have a tie to Puerto Rico and they're doing well. I mean, it's not like we're like, oh, we have a sub portfolio. No, I mean, like we're happy across the board with all of our portfolio. The other companies are based in, we have one in Brazil, 2 in Argentina, 3 in Chile, a couple in Colombia, a few in Mexico, and a few in the States that look at LATAM. Deployed for the most part that $20 million fund and now looking to raise hopefully a $50 million fund to kind of continue the investment thesis going into next year in 2025. I say with hesitancy because I'm not super excited about the conditions of the fundraising market, but I mean, I think that comes as no surprise to anybody. Times are tough.
What are you seeing? Everyone says interest rate. Everyone says, you know, people don't want to lock their money up. What are you seeing with not necessarily just like overtly asking LPs, but just like the climate right now and asking LPs?
So fund two, to answer your question in two ways, fund two outside of current market conditions is always a little difficult to raise because you have some track record, but you haven't returned capital, right? Mm-hmm. So fund one, you raise on a narrative for the most part, right? Or like the experience and the background of the general partners, the investment thesis, the story, the, you know, the opportunity to invest in a market that you're going to promote as growing and opportunistic, right?
Yep.
Or auspicious. One, two, you have a little bit of track record, right? Or you've done it for the last, say, 4 years. So now you're back in market trying to still raise on a narrative because you haven't returned capital to investors. You're still doing portfolio management, but do you know what I'm saying? Like there's some they can judge you on, there's some they can't, but you still don't have enough to say like, we had a 3X on our first fund, invest in our fund too.
Right.
As it relates to current market conditions, there's capital out there, but it's the opportunity cost to your point, right? People don't want to lock up their money in a high risk, long dated investment vehicle when they can get a blended return of 7 to 10% annualized on corporate bonds and US treasuries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which starts cash flowing immediately. So it's tough. It's looking for, at least our goal is to probably look for public funds. So CAF, the IDB, they have a mandate that they have to disperse X amount of capital. Don't have to, right? But they have a mandate that their goal is to put capital into funds, companies, et cetera, regardless of market conditions.
Mm.
When you have private investors, even pension funds, endowments that have a balanced portfolio, and especially when that balance has been just by the dynamics of the market, right? If a market's underperforming, it underweights that market, right? Because if you have 100 stocks that were valued at $100,
mm-hmm.
Now those stocks are valued at $50. The portion of your total portfolio just got chopped in half for that section of the investment, right?
Investment.
So a lot of investors that have these balanced portfolios are not looking, right, at private equity because private equity doesn't have the same mark-to-market as the markets that have been shrinking. And people are going into credit because you can get 10%+ annualized on something that's less risky than a venture investment.
Well, I'm going to ask you a very broad question now. And maybe this is a little bit more exciting and or happier, I'll say, than the answer you gave for that one. What are you most excited about right now?
the ecosystem and let them. So people always say, like, why let them? I mean, I'm from Chicago. I moved from New York. People thought I was nuts when I moved to an island. When I said I was moving to Puerto Rico, everyone was like, Costa Rica. which I still get. But looking, I mean, even like talking about Puerto Rico, right? If you look at like LAFCA data 6 years ago, it was, I mean, there was very little capital flowing into the region. Funds are popping up. I mean, Monashees is probably on its like 10th fund. So is Kazakh. Kazakh, you know, I think just announced that I think they had raised it before, like $1 billion in new capital that they're able to deploy. That didn't happen really, like 6 to 10 years ago, right? So I think the timing of let them is interesting. I don't think it's without, you know, warning signs, and that there still hasn't been like a good solution for series B, C, D, and exits in LATAM yet. I think that's still to come. Hopefully with like Adam Capital, that's the first secondary fund that we're seeing in LATAM, which I think will be a positive in terms of providing liquidity to the industry. Because to date, a lot of older funds have been finding liquidity through secondaries, but from US or kind of, you know, European buyers. So I think the ecosystem from a capital perspective in Latin America is confronting the headwinds and still growing, which I think is super exciting and kind of a testament that it's here to stay.
And so finally, I have to ask Peter Thiel's famous contrarian question with a uniquely Stamia VC twist. What is one important truth about Puerto Rico or Latin America that very few people agree with you on? And I'm going to hold you to it. You can't start the answer with, well, I don't think, no. Yeah, you got to do it.
I'm going to say this from the perspective of someone from the U.S. that had not, previous to moving down to Puerto Rico, and previous to like focusing on LATAM, because even when I was at Carlyle, I did emerging markets, like broadly defined, and very little actually happened in LATAM, is that the depth of the talent pools and the opportunity to grow a business is totally underappreciated. There's hurdles, there's frictions, but the population of LATAM is twice that of the US. And for the most part, it's two languages, right? I mean, you look at Asia, India alone has like hundreds of languages, right?
Right.
So if you're able to enter a market that's twice the size of the US, two languages, and you could just focus on Brazil or Spanish speaking LATAM, and still the markets are still massive. There's huge opportunity, both from like a private investment perspective, but also from like a corporate M&A, right? And I'm hoping, coming back to the liquidity issues in the market, that I'm hoping more US or global firms look at kind of takeout opportunities, right, in the region.
Excellent answer. Allison, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Speed VC podcast today. I very much appreciate your time.
Thanks, Chip.
Amazing.
Thank you for watching this episode of Stamia VC. Make sure to like and subscribe wherever you view the podcast. Follow me on Twitter at Gorman Tripp. And be sure to check out our newsletter, DealFlow LA, which can be found by going to dealflow.la.